Okay. Hello, Doug. You still there?
I'm here.
Good. Okay, the first item is we've got the June 6th meeting minutes. They were distributed. I'll make a motion to approve them.
I'll second the motion.
Revised them in the minutes.
Yeah, Jonathan wanted me to read something. I guess there's some technical error he wrote. The executive secretary's report from June 6th bond meeting, board meeting, that $7.5 million in capital gains had been realized. The correct amount was $6.6 million, so he wanted me to do this amendment to the minutes. Move to amend the executive secretary report contained in the minutes from the June 6, 2017 board meeting to reflect that $6.6 million in capital gains had been realized from the sale of bonds.
It was a typo.
Okay. Then,
I need a motion
to amend it. I'll second the motion to amend the minutes and approve them as amended. Any other discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Matt.
Okay. And we've got only, we've only got five loans this month, but about $4.7 million. Jonathan, are these approved for proper public purpose?
They have been, yes.
And I'll make a motion to approve the loans.
This is Doug. I'll second the motion.
Okay. Any discussion regarding the loans? Then all in favor say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
Matt, I'll vote no.
Okay, the loans are approved. Then we're ready to skip all the way to new business, and we have a presentation from 4490 Ventures. And good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
I asked Rich to give a short introduction then.
And, you know, as you know, the investment policy for the Common School Fund includes a small target allocation for venture capital. You know, this target allocation is 3%, which in today means a little bit more than $30 million. We haven't made any commitment to any investment, but we wanted to bring the board up to speed on a local opportunity that the investment committee has been reviewing. But first I wanted to provide a little bit of review of venture capital as an asset class for the board.
Thank you.
Venture capital is included in most institutional asset allocations because it provides additional diversification and higher expected returns than public equities, which are the stock market. A study by Cambridge Associates indicates that the venture capital industry has outperformed the public equity market in the prior 5, 10, and 20-year periods. Endowments and other permanent funds like the Common School Fund are able to capitalize on these higher expected returns because we have a long-term time horizon. And we also have little need for liquidity. Venture capital investments provide no annual income, but the potential for capital gains could be an important factor in the growth of the fund principal over time. In general, venture capital is an investment in a limited partnership or an LLC that makes financing available for startup companies. Venture capital investments are made over several years. VCPL would make a total dollar commitment to that fund, and then the managers of that fund would make capital calls to VCPL once they found some new investment opportunities. A good rule of thumb is that the total amount of our investment outstanding might be 50% of the total amount committed, because some of those investments would start paying off before the total commitment was funded. Individual investments are vetted by the investment managers, and the partnership investment results are highly dependent on the skills of the investment manager in picking those companies and helping them adding value to those startup companies. Now, venture capital managers take a very active role advising these companies on finance and operating matters and serving on those company boards. Studies have shown that venture capital managers are able to achieve above market returns over extended periods of time. Now, this is quite different than actively managed mutual funds, where studies have shown that active managers can't beat the market over a period of time. And I attribute that to the hands-on approach that venture capital managers take versus the analytical approach that stock pickers might take. Venture capital investments have additional risk over public equity markets. These are young companies, and some of them are going to fail. You know, this risk is diversified because each venture capital fund is going to make an investment in several different companies. And the expectation is that the winners will more than make up for the losers, and that those higher expected returns will be, provide compensation for that additional risk. And I'm sure that you've read that Wisconsin has a need for additional venture capital investment. 4490 Ventures is a local venture capital firm with offices in Madison, and they make investments in early-stage technology companies in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest. They have a good track record, and they have received firm commitments from both SWIB and WARC. The name 4490 is from the latitude and longitude of the center of the state of Wisconsin. And Dan Melvin is here to provide a little background on 4490 Ventures.
Thank you, Dan.
Explain your partners, too.
Yeah, I'm Greg Robinson, my partner. Wishes he could be here. He had a little, got in a little fight with the longboard and the pavement and ended up in the hospital. He's fine. Doctors just said, you know, take it easy for a few days. Doctors and his wife said, take it easy for a few days. And so he's unfortunately, he can't make it here. But.
So he's listening to the doctors.
Yeah, right. So, he was... had a 14-year-old nephew in town saying, hey, let's go do this. And he said, sounds great. And that's kind of the last time he's going to do that.
So. This is Doug. I'm not hearing this conversation. You guys are talking.
Okay. Sorry about that. Let's move this around a little bit. There we go. Perfect. All right. I'll go ahead and you just missed a little preamble about my partner had a... why he's not able to make it here. He sends his apologies, but under doctor's and wife's orders, he had to stay in bed today. So there's a great introduction to venture capital, and talk about, you know, how we approach this market. Venture capital has become a very sophisticated market in the capital ecosystem, and we think we have we're addressing an underserved niche, and we'll talk about that. So 4490 Ventures 2, this is our second fund. We've had 4490 Ventures Fund 1 already. That was a $30 million vehicle. Now we're raising $75 million. We're doing the same strategy and the same same approach, just larger. And so I'm going to use this. The graphic didn't show up very well on this, so you can look at it. We'll use it here to kind of focus this as well. So there's four main points I want to address, and it's really coming these highlights. So we're a very experienced team. We've had between the two of us 40 years of combined experience in both venture investing and operating startups, which is very important to be able to have done both of those, and we've done it across the country. My partner Greg spent more than a dozen years as a general partner at a Silicon Valley venture capital firm. I was in New York City doing it and also been in the Midwest. I'm a product of the Midwest. I grew up in Indiana in the cornfields outside of West Lafayette, not too dissimilar to Madison. When I wanted to come back to raise my family, I came back to the Midwest. And But I have a lot of experience. Both of us have experience across the country doing this. We are addressing an underserved market, and we use the term rise of the rest. I don't know if you're familiar with Steve Case, the founder of AOL, and his approach. He's calling it the rise of the rest, which is Silicon Valley and the Boston Northeast area have traditionally dominated venture capital. And new company formation. And his thesis is that now that the internet infrastructure has been laid, that it's now companies in other parts of the country that will develop and really, you know, rise. And he's got a lot of experience doing that. AOL was built in the Mid-Atlantic area. So we're taking a subset of that, Rise of the Midwest for the Midwest, Rise of the Rest for the Midwest. And we've got some very interesting statistics about why this is underserved, and I'll get to that in a minute. But it's a very attractive time to be investing in the West right now, in Wisconsin in particular. We have a very focused strategy. Again, the venture capital ecosystem has gotten pretty sophisticated. People playing at seed stage, growth stage, passive investing, et cetera. We're a traditional Series A lead investor. So we take board seats, We partner with the management team. We get very actively involved, and our experience as former operators of these companies is kind of prerequisite to be able to do that successfully. We are also focused on just technology, software technology, and some hardware. We're not doing life sciences. That's a whole different discipline. And we're not doing medical devices. The way that the software and hardware is evolving is these technologies are disrupting legacy industries. You just have to look at the headlines over the last few months to see that playing out in spades. Amazon buying Whole Foods, Ford replacing their CEO with the person who's running the autonomous vehicle division. It's happening, and it's been happening. Jeff Immelt stepping down at GE because the move to the whole digital world was not his strength. And then the last point is we've been doing this, and we've done it very successfully in the past. Our returns, we've on about $105 million invested in our prior careers. That's not Fund 1. That's in our careers prior to 4490. We've returned over $535 million. That's been 20 exited companies over a 20-year period. So we've gone across multiple cycles, economic cycles, and several different companies. And we're bringing to bear a very differentiated team to the Midwest market. And that's been one of the reasons the Midwest has not developed the kind of new company formation is because there has not been the venture capital talent here to do it. And we think we've got the team to do that.
This is Doug. I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Proven success, I've been reading this and listening. Maybe you will explain later, but it seems kind of impossible to me that you can return $500 million based on $100 million, and I don't quite know what an exit means.
Okay. So an exit means when a company – I'll start with that first. So we invest in a company. It's highly illiquid. We can't get our money back out. And while it's still private like that, right, it's deemed to be an illiquid asset. Once it either goes public or it gets acquired by a public company and you have a liquid security from either cash or liquid security, that's considered an exit. So we are able to exit our investment in that company. And at that point, we return capital to the limited partners of the fund. Like I said, we're the general partners, you'd be a limited partner. So the returns are fully documented as to the dollars in. We've got a spreadsheet that shows dollars in and dollars out of each company by month. That's how we're able to calculate the multiple return, that's the $535 million, and then the IRR, or the internal rate of return, which is an annual measure of how fast you get it back, that's also documented. And this has been fully vetted by SWIB and WARF. We've got signed letters from our prior locations, and that can be diligenced with our other LPs, prior LPs, if you need it.
Dan, does that include investments that in companies that have failed too?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of it. And in many cases, the nature of the beast is you have to go into companies that are pretty far out on the risk curve, and some of them will fail. And sophisticated limited partners want to make sure that they see enough failures. Otherwise, they don't deem that you're taking sufficient risk for this asset class. So we have all of that documented as well.
Is the rate of return, is that dictated by an upfront agreement, or is it just based on what the value is at the point when you exit?
Surely that. So it's how many dollars we put in this certain time period and what dollars we got back out at another time period, and then you crunch the numbers and it's...
Is there a time that you can take the money out, or you got to wait a certain amount of time?
Under rare circumstances, you can extract your money back out of the company without an exit. that's not very common. It's either in a really good situation where the company is doing so well and is so profitable they can get you out, but then you'd really rather keep writing it generally. You know, other times you can force a redemption, but it's not a very common thing in a downside scenario in a company.
And on that latter point, if you have a company that's not doing well,
mm-hmm.
Will you pull the plug on the company?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a big part of what the investment discretion is. You know, when you get it in, how much more you keep putting in over time, when do you stop, when do you try and sell the company. It's very active management of the investment.
You put a flip in Worf, tremendous. Second, you called it number two.
Yep.
$75 million.
Yeah.
And how much are Flib and Worf? Are they already committed or thinking of committing?
It's already committed, signed.
And how much are they using?
They didn't. Swib is in for $25 million and Worf is in for $20 million. We're already actually deploying capital now. We've done capital calls and everything. So we've invested in our first company already.
The first tranche was Swib in for some amount of money and Worf also.
Yeah, that was Swib. That was in the first tranche of Fund Two. $25 million from Swib, $20 million from Worf.
And now you're going for another 75.
No. Now we're filling out.
You're 30 million away.
Yeah, we're 30 million away. Yeah.
And then with either Swib or Worf in Venture One?
Yes, both Worf, yep.
And they've been out now because they're done, or?
No, that entity still exists, and we're still managing that portfolio. This is just additional commitments into Fund Two from them. So they've got $30 million at risk already in Fund One. So you could think of, through the partnership, they've got $75 million at risk currently, between $30 million of Fund One and $45 million of Fund Two. So, any other questions on some of those mechanics? I think going back to the how managers can outperform the market, it's because there is, in public markets, everybody sees the same thing, and you can buy and sell at any time. And here, you don't get access to the product, the investment product, without the companies accepting you as their investor. And so there's a whole dynamic of that. So we can be in completely different types of investments than another venture capital firm. And then how and when you are able to exit the company, that's a big part of the advice we give these entrepreneurs.
So you and your partners divide your energy, the board members on the company.
That's right. Yep. We do not anticipate making any investments where we're not taking a board seat in this fund. Which also leads us to, we're at a, you know, you have to cap the amount of money, so we have a hard cap of $100 million we would raise. If everything goes well, we may go over our 75 to 100, but we'll stop there because as two partners, we can't effectively deploy more than $100 million in the style that we do it. So if you go to the next slide here, again, the graphics, I apologize for the graphics on this. You can see it on here. It's a little easier to see. The imbalance between what we call the innovation inputs, or inputs to the innovation economy, and institutional venture capital are significant. I wish I could draw this to scale, but you wouldn't even be able to see it. If you look on the left, the inputs are generally about 25%, between 20 and 30% of the U.S. And that's from GDP, and we define the Midwest here as nine states. So the GDP, the headquarters of the Inc. 5000, which is fastest growing private companies, and that's a measure of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial growth and entrepreneurial teams. 21% of that is in the Midwest. Fortune 500 headquarters, 27% of those exist in the Midwest. And those become very important as acquirers, as customers, as sources of executive talent, that's where, especially if you're going after existing industries, that's, you're either disrupting them or enabling them. It depends on the management of those companies, which path they choose. And then, I think we all know the phenomenal universities we have in the Midwest. If you look at engineering R&D dollars, almost a third of all engineering R&D dollars exist in the Midwest. And 27% of all graduating engineers come out of the Midwest. Historically, the problem has been these engineers go to the coast because that's where the companies have been that they need, that employ them and pay the most and have the most exciting careers for them. That's a, you know, the brain drain, we all know it, right? It's a real problem. If we can capture that back in the Midwest, then it's a, you know, it's a significant win for the region and for the country as well. A strong central part of the country is important for everyone. And then interestingly, if you LinkedIn and Trulia is a real estate company, did a survey of the most attractive cities of the most attractive cities in the U.S. for new college graduates. 9 of the top 10 were in the Midwest. That was pretty interesting. Now contrast that to institutionally backed venture capital. And institutionally backed would be institutions like yourselves as opposed to family offices. It's institutionally backed venture capital, only 5% of that exists in the same region, both in terms of dollars invested in companies in the region, whether those firms were in California and investing here, or whether it's assets under management of the firms investing. Both of those numbers are 5%. So what does that mean? It means on the coast, you've got the opposite imbalance. So it gets much more competitive there. Prices are going up. Here in the Midwest, when you've got supply and demand in your favor, it's makes for very attractive investments. Now, if you flip to the next slide, you can see sort of the manifestation of that. In realized investments, realized versus unrealized just means realized investments are things that have exited and that we have returned capital back to our limited partners. Unrealized means the companies are still private and we're still managing them. All right, so if you look at all of our realized investments, there's been 20 initial investments, and we say initial because we do follow-on investing to the same company, but 20 companies. And that's the $105 million invested, $535 returns, almost a gaudy IRR, 146%. We're not saying we're going to continue to do that. But it's very attractive. If you look at unrealized just for a minute, there's 20 investments out there in our track record that have not realized yet. Majority of it has been since 2014, so it wouldn't expect to have realized. And we've got a nice, you know, carrying value in IRR on that, but we're pretty conservative in how we carry those at most of
the time. How many years over is the one on the left for 105?
20 years.
20?
Yeah.
So does this mean that you're on 20 boards, though?
No. Many of those were smaller investments before I joined up were basically angel investments,
okay.
Or I had a smaller vehicle, or I'm not on those. That style of investing, I said, I'll give you the money and a little bit of time, but I'm not going to serve on your board,
right.
As opposed to here, you know, we are. So right now I'm on, yeah.
Different strategy.
Yeah, right, different strategy. Now, if you look at the center box, that's where when we went to underserved geographies. So we cut our data. We took the 20 and said, all right, take the ones that were in Silicon Valley and the Northeast, take those out of our numbers because that's where it's so competitive and your supply-demand is not in your favor. What was left were 11 investments, 11 realizations, and that wasn't just the Midwest. You know, we also invested in the Mid-Atlantic, Southeast, Pacific Northwest. That was 11 investments, $70 million at cost was deployed, $470 was returned. So the vast majority of our returns came from underserved geographies. 7x multiple on that. Out of those, we had 4 IPOs, 6 M&A exits, and only 1 shutdown. And of those IPOs, currently, as of the end of 2016, those companies had a $9 billion market cap. Now, what those companies do to the regions where they exist, you almost can't, you know, overstate it, right? Those kind of companies become anchors for more talent, more startups. That's how regions develop. So you need those big wins that remain independent to keep the innovation wheel turning. Two other data points on the underserved geographies. 45%, 5 of 11, of those individual investments returned more than 5 times our capital, which is good. But what is, you know, almost shocking, it surprised us even when we looked at this, 82% of our investments, 9 of 11, generated more than a 30% annual internal rate of return. And that's, you know, you just don't see that very often. And it's because of we were hunting where others weren't. The supply and demand was in our favor.
This is Doug. I have a quick question.
Yep.
What is typically the amount of money that you invest in these? Is it $1 million or $20 million, or is it quite different?
So there are a couple of different strategies that we deployed over our careers. So if you look at the all realized investments in the upper left, 20 investments, 20 companies, $105 million invested. So it's about average about $5 million per company on that
okay.
one. As I said before, before I joined 4490, I had a strategy where I was doing more angel investing and smaller, so that's how we got a larger number, but smaller dollar amounts. For 4490, we're going to be investing between $5 to $8 million per company over the life of the company. Probably about half of that in the initial investment, and then we reserve the other half for the follow-on. That's if we're at a $75 million fund, those would be the numbers. If we get to a $100 million fund, we won't increase the number of companies because we can't take more board seats, but we will increase the dollar amount. So that will go from $5 million to $10 million per company over the life will be the target. Go to the next slide. Any other questions before I move on? No? Okay. If you go to the next slide... again, the graphics are a little easier to see on here. This is our Fund 1. This is an update on our Fund 1. Now, it is a young portfolio, general 2014, 2015, some 2016 investments, so you wouldn't expect it to have any realizations. But the important point here is two points. It's the same strategy that we'll be doing in Fund 2, which is Midwest-based companies, lead investor, active on the board. We have meaningful ownership stakes in each of these companies, and we're capitalizing these businesses with enough to really develop sustainable intellectual property and differentiation to become much larger. We have seen some good positive developments in the portfolio. So if you look at the kind of bottom right, the in the 2 years. So we kind of normalized it for 2 years since initial investment in this portfolio. Aggregate revenue was $4 million at the time of investment. 2 years later, it's $30 million. So 7x increase in revenue. Not always a proxy for equity value, but a good one. And so we think that if this growth continues and the exit multiples that you get from either the public market or the M&A buyers continue as they are, we think we'll do a 5X DPI, the acronym there stands for distribution to paid-in capital. So whatever you guys put in, you get 5X back.
Yeah. John, are those the five companies that you invested
yep.
in?
Yep. One of them, Understory, we actually moved back from Boston. It was a University of Wisconsin graduate in the area of meteorology. It's a Internet of Things data company focused on weather that we've got low-cost hardware we distribute around different geographies that captures what we call ground truth of weather information. If you think about that, weather historically has all been determined by the sky, satellite or radar. And you lose fidelity when you do that. You have to make assumptions. What is actually happening on the ground is the best source of truth. But historically, it just hadn't been possible. You didn't have low cost enough hardware, and you couldn't wire that hardware up to a wireless connection up to the cloud
no pun on that one, but up to be able to do the algorithms and the calculations to then shoot the information back down to insurance adjusters are a big customer of this, and obviously farming industry. Like I said, the founders started at UW. They wanted to keep it here. Capital wasn't here. They moved to Boston, got it going there. 4490 started. We got to know them, talked to them, said, you can bring this business back to the Midwest, and they did. So their company is headquartered in Madison now. We brought True Ventures, which is a very well-respected Silicon Valley venture firm, in as a co-investor, and Monsanto came in as a co-investor. So because obviously Monsanto needs to be on the leading edge of weather data collection and analysis, and they saw that this was the bet that they made on that. HealthMind is another one that significant intellectual property, mostly based on folks that came out of the university in one way or another. It's in the area of computer vision around radiology images. It's making the connection between radiologists and the physicians that rely on them more efficient using information technology. We've raised $15 million for that company pre-revenue, which you can do if you're solving a sufficiently difficult problem. You can warrant that kind of risk, and these folks are, and we think that it's still early, but we think that'll be a big outcome for the region. Abodo and Eat Street are also based in Madison. Networked Insights has a large operation in Madison, but technically headquartered in Chicago.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So if you go to the next slide, summary, again, we're raising $75 million. We have $45 million already in the bank, and we have a hard cap of $100 million. There'll be 12 to 15 companies in that portfolio, very consistent with Fund One, and we're very excited about the opportunity here to do that. That type, that style of investing. The Fund Two return potential. Let's talk about again. Some of the venture funds have gotten very large, $500 million, $1 billion. It gets much more difficult to return. Just the law of large numbers makes it difficult to return high numbers on that. We're still a small fund in the big scheme of the industry, so a single M&A exit has the potential to return the entire fund. We could have $10 million in, we get a 10x return on that one fund, and we returned $100 million, and that's it. Everything else on top of that is gravy. And an IPO exit has the potential to return multiples of the fund. So That's why we want to keep the fund relatively small.
Is that because IPOs occur later in the stage of the company than an M&A?
They're just larger. IPOs can become just that much larger in general.
So this is Doug again. I'm not very familiar with this, so I may ask a dumb question, but I don't understand for sure who and when the company or the fund managers, you guys, decide that the money should come out. Let's say you give a company $10 million to get going, and they start going, and they're making good progress, or they're hiring employees, they're finding customers, they're making money. At what time do they give money back to the fund, which they've been given to the investors?
That's not a dumb question at all. I mean, that is one of the central questions of this whole asset class. And it's a bit of a black art. It's a lot of conversations with among the board, the investors, the management team, corporate partners. There's no easy answer to that. You have to look. It's very situation specific. Should you sell now? Should you sell the company now? And because we don't take it out of the company when it's without a liquidity event, which is either being bought by a larger company or taking it public. So that we generally don't get the money out until those. So that, but the discussions are on when do you do that? And there's any number of examples of companies that did maybe did it too early, companies that didn't. You know, it was I think you know, Google had an offer on the table to be bought. I want to say it was maybe $500 million, which was more money than the founders could have ever dreamed of in their lives. But yet, you know, they didn't take it, and you know, there they are today. It, you know, and there's any company of significant size has had that same question. You know, when do you sell, and when do you keep invest? It's like, you know, are you harvest mode, or are you in planting mode? And it's a black art, and that's
well,
what
so,
but, experienced managers to help them through that.
So I'm more confused. I understand that if the startup is taken over by somebody, then they would receive a big chunk of money for that. And then I presume that would be allocated on a percentage basis as to how much would go to the investors?
Correct. Yes, that's right.
Okay. But it's also possible for the investors to get revenue if the company decides not to be sold but continue to grow and profit.
No. We generally do not take distributions out of the company.
Okay. So as investors, if we were to give you $25 million to fill out your cap, say, of $100 million, then we would have to wait until some of the companies that you invest in decided to sell, and that could be 10 years or 20 years or who knows.
Right, but you also have a portfolio. That's why you... So some companies will sell earlier, some later, but you're correct, you know, directionally in that, yes, it, we have to wait for the liquidity event. We as managers have a lot of influence on that, but we don't control it. Now, the other way to get an exit, to get liquidity back, is when they go public. So at that point, we as the fund managers can choose to sell our shares on the public market and return cash back, or in some cases we could return shares that you then manage when to sell them. If
okay, I got it. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. The next slide is really just a summary of the terms. We said fund size there. The GP commitment, Greg and myself are the general partners of the fund, and we're putting up 2% of the capital. The total capital committed is coming out of our pockets. The minimum commitment size for a limited partner, I don't think it's an issue here, is $5 million. We do have another part of the mechanics of this is the investment period lasts for 5 years. So we started it, we closed in January of this year, we did our first close. So that means we have 5 years to make initial investments in companies. After that five-year period, we cannot make any more new investments in new companies. We can do follow-on investments in existing companies after that, but no more new companies after 5 years.
Is there a time frame for capital calls then? Is that limited to 7 years, or how do you do that?
The fund life is 10 years. Generally, it's 8 to 10 years over for the full capital to be called. That makes sense then. If any questions on that, let me know.
Here's another question.
Yep.
If we gave you $25 million to invest, what happens if you don't find a potential client for that? Then do we get an interest on that money, or what's the story there?
No, we don't call it. So it remains in your accounts. We never call it down.
Doug, we make a commitment for a certain capital level, and it's not utilized unless they're investing in a company. So
okay.
If we hold the money, let's say we said we're going to commit to $15 million. After 3 or 4 years, they may have half of that invested, but the other half is still in our hands.
Right, and we would have that money invested in other things in the time, because we have enough liquidity in order to meet those capital calls without too much trouble.
Yeah.
No, I understand now. I understand. Thank you.
Yeah. I may have inadvertently confused things when I said we have $45 million in the bank. That's a euphemism. We have $45 million committed. We only have, you know, a few million. I don't know what the number is. A few million that is actually in the bank.
Can we ask you who are the other people who have committed to this?
That's SWIB and Wharf. SWIB has committed $25 million. Wharf has committed $20 million.
So you have $45 million committed now.
That's right.
And you're looking to go to 75 or with the top of 100.
That's right.
I got it. Thank you.
The carried interest is standard. This is industry standard, both the carried interest and management fee, which means the general partners, it's 20. So you get all your capital back. So say you put $25 million in. You get your capital back, and then 80% of the gains on top of that, and we keep 20% of the gains, our incentive fee. And management fee is 2.5% per year. Again, that's industry standard. During the investment period, so during the first 5 years, it's 2.5%. After that, it drops down to a quarter point each year to a floor at 1.5%. That's per year. And your capital returned is net of the management fee. So there's no you get all your capital, including anything that we drew down as management fee before we take any carried interest. So these are all very vanilla terms in the industry. And that's the end of the presentation.
So the money you and your partner make is are the management. Nothing paid for serving on the board.
I can't hear other people.
He asked whether any other forms of income for us as the partners, like serving on a board. The answer to that is no. In private equity funds, oftentimes they do that. In venture capital funds, you don't do it. We serve on the boards. That's the way we service our LPs. So we're getting paid through that, and that's it. And we also don't make... We don't make any investments in our own personal money in these companies. Everything is through the funds. It's written into our documents that we can't do anything outside of. I mean, we could invest in a restaurant or something like that, but nothing that would be a candidate for a fund, a potential fund investment.
Individuals or companies who are looking to do. To make some, to start up a company, do they find you or do you find them? How does that work?
Both. So there's a relatively active angel market out there investing now. So we're not doing angel or seed and stage investing. So it's high net worth individuals. There's some funds that have got put together that are maybe $10 million fund or something, and they're doing $250,000 investments. So they're the first source generally. They're in the company, so we have very good relationships with them. So a lot of times those earlier stage investors come to us. Because we're known in the market, we've got a lot of relationships among them. Or sometimes some of our best sources are existing portfolio companies or prior portfolio companies that we've invested in. Entrepreneurs find those management teams. Say, hey, you know, 4490 has been great. Go talk to them. So it's a pretty fluid
relationship based.
Yeah, very much relationship based. Yeah. You good?
Yeah.
All right, great.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, no problem. All right. Turn this off.
I want you to leave it on.
You have to leave it in about 15
minutes. Right. I'm quicker than that, but I've got 11 o'clock.
Contacted me this morning, and he had a good point. I sent out an email also on that to you, board members, and that is that I asked that the logo for BCPL be put on a document. I inadvertently, well, I just didn't realize that the names of commissioners was on it as well, so I've excised that on future iterations, and it's and the document clearly states that it's prepared by BCPL staff. And so I think that Matt had a decent point on that. No, that's my error. If you've had a chance to review this document as commissioners, have you, Doug?
Pardon me?
Have you had a chance to review this land bank review document?
Yes, I read it this morning.
Good. All right. Well, that's if maybe I can just say if there are any questions about it, I can highlight it. The first front of it is the kind of a restatement of what the land bank legislation was and how it came to be passed. And now we've got our review underway. We were asked when the legislation was passed to provide a periodic update to the legislature. I'm not aware that we've been doing that. So I think this you can consider this as an update from staff to the board. We've increased our timber base from 27,000 to 33,600 acres. We've sold 15,000 plus acres and through today, and we've purchased 12,900 acres through to 2015. As you know, we haven't purchased any property since spring of 2015. If you go through this, you can sort of see how we're performing. I would submit that the land bank authority is arguably accomplishing its intended purposes. Our revenue has gone up rather dramatically. Look at the very last page of this document. You can see.
I read it last night. I thought it was pretty easy to understand.
Okay. Well, that's really it in a nutshell. The question really it revolves around, we've got the existing law, which says that any proceeds from the sale of land shall be used to invest in timber. But that is ultimately a board decision, and you vote on those things. I believe we turned one purchase down before I came on board that I'm aware of. We have not made any since then. But I do think it's important to note that if you compare apples to apples, we're roughly equivalent to the county forest that we're comparable to in terms of dollars per cord and dollars per acre.
On the better land, right?
That's exempting all of this crud. If you look on the second page, of our 75,000 acres, 21,900 acres are wetlands. Obviously, those are a drag on that. 31,000 acres of productive timberland as of now, and the lower figure here is related to the normal fund. And heck, we have 1,200 acres completely underwater.
There's a curiosity thing that I had as I was going through this. Our land that is completely submerged, that's because somebody dammed a river?
Right, for flowage.
Yeah.
Like we have 160 acres below Beaver Dam Lake.
Okay.
We'd love to sell the Beaver Dam, but we don't think we can make that sale. So that's the status of it, and I think...
Can we start charging people who fish above our land?
What do you think, Tom?
I'd love to say yes. Unfortunately, we got that land already underwater. It was a special act of Congress about 1912 when the dam was already in place. That specified that those lands were considered swamp lands pursuant to the Swamp Land Act of 1850 and granted to the state of Wisconsin under that.
We do have some rights in flowage if the flowage is removed or if you're with the water authority.
Well, and there are other situations where the land was flowed by a dam without our permission. So
we have some legal rights on some of them.
I guess, this is Matt. We don't have a lot of time, but I've got to leave, and we can deal with it another time. Obviously, you guys know where I come from. I don't support the bland purchases. I'm not going to support them. Doug and I probably disagree on that. Brad's obviously the decider. My point is, you all talk all the time about how we do a really good job with bonds and the investments. I just see that that's what we're supposed to be doing with the loans and so forth. We do a better job of that. I don't like that this little agency is managing when another agency could do it. Obviously, you know, I put Representative August and Senator Knotts on a bill. This obviously came out right after it. The timing's interesting. But my whole point is, I don't support this. I think it goes against what we're doing in our constitutional mission. We have not bought any land in the 2.5-3 years I've been on this board. I think at a minimum, this board should look at, and I'll have the legislature, I'm going to be working on that, the fact that we have a fund that has $2.5 million in it, we can only buy land.
I think $3.4 million.
Well, whatever it is. But I think the concept of it's taking the, whether it's Doug, Brad, or I, it limits our options. There's no reason we couldn't give that out in a loan. There's no reason we couldn't do it in a bond. I think the fact that it says only invested in land, I don't know why the legislature is limiting us on that, and I think the commissioner should have the authority to invest in other things. So that's one option. And I'll leave with Brad, and Doug, I'll email you a copy. My whole point is, if you look at, we've only bought, looks like 20 parcels of land, and if what you all, you know, talk about as being your best thing, loans and bonds, we make about 4% at least. My whole point is, if we had invested that money, and just even the loan, and not in other options, which we now have equities. We can buy stocks and bonds. We would have made almost $4 million because we sold some of this land in 2006. We sold $1.5 million. We would have made $600,000 in loans. We don't make much because we have to spend so much to manage the land. We at least spend as much to manage as we
take. That's actually not true anymore.
Well, it has been, and I would contest
that. Prior to land banking, it was certainly a...
And I would contest that it is, but... And
well, land banking is giving them the ability to reduce the cost of managing the land. And the land that we're taking out by getting rid of it is not land that's valuable. It's land that costs more to manage. And instead, with the land bank, the structure of the land bank, where it's increasing timber management efficiency, increasing public access, and reducing fragmentation, that's making it cheaper to manage. We have to live in, first of all, we have to use the law as it exists. And
well,
if somebody changes it, then we change what
we're
doing.
But the board pushed this law to be only.
I don't think that Speaker Jensen was a guy who got pushed into anything.
No,
I
but
think Scott Jensen made decisions based on what he thought was best for Wisconsin, and nobody did a Jedi mind trick on him.
Well, the selling of the land is there's nothing. The land bank portion where we sell the land, there's nothing wrong with that. There's portions of the land bank that are fine. Giving the people that when we buy the land up there, that's just one reason they bought in as the northern legislators, because then they get a pill payment. The point is, we sold land. We didn't have to buy new land. That's my whole point. When you're saying when we sold land, we bought a parcel. This was 1.5. This was the one J.B. Van Hollen complained about. This is what we owned. We bought this, 3,000 acres, and I know, Doug, you can't see it. This is what we bought, and we own that. This is an Iron County. That's not making our you know, buying and in-holdings. It's not like we bought this little square. This was, frankly, stupid. And so this is, J.B. Van Hollen said in the meeting, why are we buying this? Shouldn't we be investing this in loans? And he was shot down and said, listen, this is the law. We can't do anything else. So, again, if this was brought for us today, I know I wouldn't vote for it, and I doubt you might. But this is not what we're supposed to do.
If that were separately considered, I don't believe we would recommend buying it.
Well, they did, obviously, in 2009.
I think it was part of a larger package. Am I correct on that, Tom?
The reason for that particular one was more because of the fact that it gave us a chance to buy a block of land at the same time at a much lower price. And the timber projections on it made it sound like it would be a...
This is Doug. Can I interrupt for a minute?
Go ahead.
I mean, I read over your summary, and as someone who has lived through this, the only board member who has, it's accurate and clarifies. I thank you for doing that. My question is, what are we talking about now? I mean, I'm listening to the treasurer going on about purchases done in the past, etc. What is the point of our discussion here?
I don't want to sit here forever.
The document that was put out, basically,
and I've been on the phone for more than an hour already now.
We can get going. We have that presentation. All I'm saying is this was a $1.5 million purchase, and it was bought in the lowest part of the market. Now, granted, you guys did not have authority to buy equities back then, but obviously we could have tried to push it or even a bond. Fuse is an example. I just put three companies on here, and obviously I picked some good companies, but Johnson Controls is the largest company in Wisconsin, largest in public traded. That $1.5 million, if we invested it March 30th of 2009, would be worth over $10 million today. Now, I understand you couldn't do that. I understand that. I recognize that. But we do today. So if we had the same thing standing in front of us, why would we invest $1.5 million in land when, at a minimum, you guys want to buy equities? You want venture capital. That would be a better investment. My only point, I'm not supporting land. You guys get that, and that's it. We haven't had any land purchases in front of us, and if Brad wants to make one and Doug does, then that's their decision, but I'm not going to support it. I'll leave it at that.
The reason for this review is because we're anticipating that there may be some land decisions in front of you in this coming month.
You have a few lined up already?
We've been trying to find some land that met all the criteria, all three criteria, and have not identified but one parcel that really makes it.
If we didn't have that limitation in that statute where it says we can only buy land, would you say it'd be better, would you want to at least consider investing in venture capital, stocks or whatever, bonds?
Well, we have an investment policy that says we can invest 15% of our assets in equity.
Mm-hmm.
We've not done that yet.
Yep.
I should say, however, that we haven't been inactive. We've realized just the other day, $1.1 million in capital gains. Now have
7.7.
Okay. And we filled the smoothing fund for the normal school fund with capital gains, so that's been completed. Actually, this year, because of our performance in timber and investment, we just cut a check to the university for $465,000, which is a 16% increase over last year, because our performance is improving. The value of owning land is that it adds to the growth of the fund.
Yeah, but we could also own venture capital. We could own many other things
we could go on the team.
But there's one fundamental reality that, you've talked about this before. There's a fundamental reality that we can't just sell all of our land at once. And so it makes sense to find ways to enhance the value of our land so that as we sell this in coming years, it's worthwhile. And in the interim, mm-hmm. It's cheaper for BCPL to manage the land, and you can actually pull a little profit off of it. So there's a little bit of horse trading, but there is the rule that we can't grow the size of, you can't grow the number of acres, and that. The number of acres is reducing, but it's becoming more valuable land, which long-term does fit in our fiduciary responsibility.
My only point is we sold 16, we bought about 14. We didn't have to buy the 14, is my point, because we would have been 16 million.
We're hashing old stories. I've been on the phone
more. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. That's my point. I disagree with the document.
I have no idea how I would have voted on that particular purchase. Yep. Years ago, I don't know.
No.
Looking forward, I would want to identify if a proposal was made. I'd want to be looking to make sure that it met as many, if not all, of these criteria as possible, so that it really does enhance the value of what we're doing, reduce the cost of what we're managing. That we can't just flood the market right now.
How many options of land purchases do you, because we have 3.4 million in this account, you said?
Mm-hmm.
How many options of land do you think are relatively sitting out there that you'd consider?
I can't answer that, Matt. I've only identified one for less than
1,000. Less than 1,000 what?
Less than 1,000 acres.
How much money would that be, a million?
Well, we've got an appraisal on it.
Our
appraisal is about, what, $1,250?
Yeah, about $1.1 something.
I'm talking $1,250 per acre.
Oh, yeah.
About $1.2 million or so?
$1.1 million.
Okay, so that would be something you'd bring before the board. Is it contiguous to our current land?
We have not completed negotiating with the property owner because they want more than their appraisal, and so we're in a...
All right, well, my only point is I would invest that elsewhere, whether it's venture capital or something else. That would be obviously up to the other two commissioners.
Well, I guess, I understand your position. As the director of this outfit, I have to follow the law that
it
exists.
But I think the law that it limits us, as J.B. Van Hollen said back in 2009, I think that part should be cleaned up. And again, I understand we're not the lawmakers. That's the legislature's job. I don't know why we would tie our hands to only buy land. It seems silly.
Okay, come on.
I'm done. I'm good.
Okay.
This is in your hands. I already, as far as my report, I wanted to report that we've got $465,000 in a check cut to UW, which is a record increase. And we're projecting that we'll exceed that next year on current trends as timber revenue and investments. Our capital gains are, give me that figure again, Rich.
About $7.7 million. Yesterday I sold a $10 million bond, and we earned a little bit over $1 million capital gain on that. I also have a bond purchase to report. We finally got a separate account for our earnings that are held over to the next distribution. And so we had $14 million to invest there. And so I bought a treasury bond that actually matures right before the distribution. We're getting 1.2% on that compared to 0.7% in the state investment fund. And so we'll earn a little bit more than $50,000 over the state investment fund on
just
that.
Just keeping
bond.
Liquidity for that distribution. Other than that, I don't think I have anything to report. I did say that the normal school fund, smoothing fund, is now full. And actually, because of the rising distribution, that smoothing fund is tied to the 50% of the annual distribution. We probably will want to raise that smoothing fund level moving forward as we're increasing our distribution to the UW.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Relative to the land bank review, there's a responsibility to make a report to the legislature periodically.
Yeah.
So far, periodically has been...
I don't believe we've done it.
Once. Never, yeah. Okay. this has been adjusted to reflect that this is prepared by BCPL staff. Do we want to submit this to the legislature as a BCPL staff report of the land bank?
That's your
issue.
Call. I would like to be able to discuss it with key legislators, but I don't want to misrepresent what it is. And I think Matt called me on it appropriately.
Okay.
This is Doug. My only comment about what I think I heard there in the last part is that I think that I haven't gotten a lot of feedback from people, but I have heard occasionally from people that don't understand this whole process. So I think that for Jonathan to be able to share this report with members of the legislature or reporters or whoever is curious about it would be a desirable thing, and I would hope that he could do that.
Well, it'll be attached to the board minutes of today because it's a handout today. At a minimum.
Good. Thank you.
If we're wanting to take a position on it, that'd be fine, too.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm just opposed to it 100%. That's fine. Support it one dozen, that's fine.
It is the law as it exists. We have a responsibility to submit a periodic report. Other than the disagreement conceptually or philosophically with this idea, is there something factually that's not accurate?
Well, I mean, it says in the report that we are, you know, doing, for example, using land bank legislation to reshape the school trust fund portfolio into a more productive asset is in keeping with the constitutional intent.
It is.
I don't believe it is at all. So whether you think it's factual or not, I don't think it is. I mean, if the whole point was to to keep the land at $3 million and then just do timber cuts the whole time and then grow the fund that way, then they could have done that. That could have been the constitutional intent. It says to sell the land. It's pretty clear to sell the land. Us keeping $77,000 or whatever it is forever, or selling some and keeping it, just lowering it to $72,000, $71,000, whatever, I just don't think it's a constitutional intent. Whether you guys agree with me or not, that's just fine. I just don't.
Here we go again.
To that point, if you guys want to just say that this was adopted by the you two support the position, and I don't, that's fine. I mean, I'm going to be working actively against it, and at least that only part for sure, because I think we should be buying other stuff. but you
okay.
Can that's fine.
This is Doug. With a question for Jonathan.
Yes,
hello?
Sir. Yes, I'm right here.
Do you think that you want a motion from the board to accept your report? If that's necessary, I'd make a motion that we accept your report.
That's a good compromise, just to accept the report.
I'll second that. Any other discussion? Then all in favor say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Doug.
And I'll vote nope.
Okay.
All right.
I've got nothing else.
All right. Doug, we do recall that you had the future agenda item that Jonathan will get on a future agenda. Anything else?
No, it's good, and I thank you all for letting me participate. The venture capital thing was quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I just don't know enough about that whole world to know whether we're better off to give them money or we're better off to buy AT&T. You know, I don't know. I'll have to have our staff think about it.
Can I try and answer that, Doug? I don't know the answer to that either, other than we're always better off to have diversification in our risk portfolio.
That makes sense.
I would say this. We vetted this pretty thoroughly and spent a great deal of time with SWIB on the due diligence that they conducted and are satisfied that this is probably a very good thing to do. However, we think it would be unwise to put our entire allocation into this because they're focused on software and hardware, and there's a whole biomedical and medical devices arena that we might want to hold our powder dry for. So we're not talking about putting our entire allocation in this at all.
The only concern I have from their presentation is the time frame, in the sense that we have no control over when we would get back our profit, if you will. With other kind of mutual fund kind of situations, if you buy so many shares of a mutual fund, you know that you're going to be getting a return on a regular basis.
That's exactly right, Doug, and that's one of the reasons that the returns have to be higher in this type of investment, is because a lot of investors they need more certainty than that.
All right.
Another question. Sorry to be holding us up here. Are you somewhat serious about asking us to let you give them $10 million or something, or what's happening next?
Well, I think within the investment allocation, we've been, you've given us the authority to make a venture capital investment. We thought this presentation was useful. I think our recommendation would be to be as considerably below the asset allocation limit and probably less than half of that. I don't want to go into an investment in venture capital without the diligence that we've already been given through SWIB and WHARF.
It makes sense to me. If those two public entities who have to have a serious responsibility, if they think it's a good thing, then I guess it's probably a pretty good thing.
Well, and also we've got legislative leaders that are, kind of desirous of seeing some venture capital focus in Wisconsin. 4490
yeah.
stands for a geographic point in the center of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. I mean, that's one of our problems we've had here, is that we graduate people and then they disappear and Wisconsin doesn't benefit from the job production.
I think we got to call it here. I'm going to make a motion to adjourn. You ready to go here?
I will motorize.
Amy notarized this. Yes, I'll second the motion to adjourn, and all in favor say aye. Aye, Brad.
Aye, Matt.
I vote no, just for fun.
All right. Bye, Doug.
Bye, Doug.
Oh, she notarized that the wrong place? She did. And so all I'm asking, is this your signature? I will notarize it. I'll cross her out, and I'll notarize it. Matt, we're done.
Okay. Bye, Doug.
Okay. Oh.